Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, we've got an all-books edition of Culturetopia. To start, a look at how independent bookstores are finding a silver lining in an era of online buying. Rapper and record mogul Jay-Z talks about his childhood and the stories behind his most famous songs in a new book. And a young American returns to his parents' home country in the new book, India Calling. It explores the country's reinvention of what it means to be Indian. But first...
In the small chapel in St. Bavo's Cathedral in the Belgian city of Ghent, you can find one of the world's most famous and sought-after paintings. It's called the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, but it's better known as the Ghent Altarpiece.
It's an absolutely enormous monumental triptych consisting of 12 painted oaken panels, many of them painted on both sides.
That's art historian Noah Charney, and it's safe to say, like many before him, he's obsessed with this painting. It consists of 24 scenes that depict a pilgrimage through heaven.
You can see individual hairs of varying colors on the beard of John the Baptist, for instance. You can see dirt under fingernails. You can see soil and grass stains on the soles of the feet of pilgrims.
The painting is attributed to the Flemish artist Jan van Eyck. He finished it in 1432, but parts of it may also have been painted by his brother, Hubert. And unlike any other painting in the world, the Ghent altarpiece has been stolen, vandalized, or held for ransom at least 7 times, most recently during the Second World War. And a part of it is still missing. Noah Charney tells the story of the altarpiece in his new book. It's called Stealing the Mystic Lamb.
This painting is arguably the single most influential painting ever made, and that may sound like a very big statement.
Right.
But because it's the first great oil painting, it influenced oil painting for centuries to come, the first great panel painting of the Renaissance. The monumentality of it and the complexity of it fascinated people from the moment it was painted. But there's also this sense that I would call cumulative desire. The very fact that it was coveted by so many people, the number one target of Denon, the first director of the Louvre Museum, the number one target of Hitler, all these reasons bound up together to render this quite possibly the single most coveted artwork in history.
For the first sort of 150 years of its existence, it sits in a church in Ghent in relative peace and quiet. And then towards the end of the 16th century, the real story of what starts to happen to this painting begins. It's eventually stolen by soldiers during the French Revolution. Parts of it are taken to Paris and displayed at the Louvre, then repatriated after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. In the early 19th century, some of the panels are effectively stolen by a vicar at the church and sold to a German collector. They go back to the church in Ghent after the First World War under the Treaty of Versailles. And then in 1934, one of the panels is stolen, and it's never been found. Do you think it's out there?
I do. This is the enduring mystery that really is part of the popular cultural awareness of the people of Ghent still to this day. In 1934, this one panel was stolen in the night, and it was a first thought that this was a political theft because the thief or thieves left a note pinned to the altarpiece where the panel had been, saying, "Taken from Germany by the Treaty of Versailles." It was thought that this was a pro-German nationalistic act of retribution.
Hmm.
But then the first of 13 ransom notes came to the bishop's office at Ghent, and the bishop would not comply. The police took over the negotiations. And after 13 ransom letters were sent back and forth, the police gave up. They had no leads. They had a very strange investigation that smacked to many of conspiracy or cover-up.
Hmm.
For instance, when the police first arrived at the crime scene in 1934, they got there late because they had been investigating the theft of cheese from a local cheese shop. And after they took everything in, looked for clues, which by this time had been obliterated by crowds of people flocking to see the missing panel, they returned to the cheese shop, deeming the theft of the cheese of more urgency than the theft of this piece of their national patrimony.
I'm speaking with Noah Charney. His new book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb. It's about Jan van Eyck's famous painting known as the Ghent Altarpiece. No, I should mention that you, aside from being an art historian at the American University in Rome, you also run a foundation that is focused on finding stolen artwork and researching it. What's your theory? Where do you think it might be?
It's one of the iconic art thefts in history. And there are all sorts of odd and fascinating conspiracy theories about why the panel would be stolen, because the ransom demand itself was not for a high enough amount of money to suggest that money was the main motivation. Some people think that it was stolen. This may sound very silly, but in fact, the Nazis and Hitler in particular were absolutely convinced that the occult and the supernatural was real. And one theory runs that the altarpiece's panel was stolen in 1934 to prevent it from being stolen eventually by the Nazis. And it was stolen by the Nazis in World War II in order to keep a key panel out of Hitler's hands, because this painting contained a coded treasure map to Catholic iconic relics, the Arma Christi, the instruments used at Christ's Passion that would grant supernatural powers to the possessor. And that may sound like absolutely crazy
maybe
to us
like
now,
like the next Dan Brown novel.
Well, it's based on reality, and the Indiana Jones films, too, are based on a real Nazi research unit called the Achnenerbe, which was essentially a supernatural research unit that was investigating, looking for the Holy Grail and the Spear of Destiny, the Ark of the Covenant, and some think stole the Ghent altarpiece because they thought it contained this treasure map.
Hitler was obsessed with this painting, and as you say, the Nazis did in fact steal it, and they held it in a salt mine in Austria throughout the Second World War. As the war was coming to an end and the Germans realized they were losing, they were very close to destroying it. How was it saved?
That's perhaps the most dynamic and cinematic of the stories. It was the number one object chased after by both Hermann Göring, who was stealing literally thousands of masterpieces for his personal collection, and Hitler wanted it as the centerpiece for his planned super museum at Linz, Austria, his boyhood town. And it was eventually saved through heroism on the part of some unlikely sources, the heroism of Austrian miners working for the resistance, through the adventures of a commando team of Austrian double agents who were parachuted in to try to use guerrilla tactics to prevent the destruction of the mine by the local SS Gauleiter, who was determined to blow up all of the thousands of masterpieces if they couldn't be defended against the Allies. And then the good fortune and detective work of two Allied monuments men with the Third Army under General Patton. And there was this race on the one hand with the Allies trying to get to the mine before the local SS could blow it up, with the Austrian double agents working with the Austrian miners in the resistance trying to delay the detonation of it.
Oh, wow.
And it was very close to every one of those works being completely destroyed.
How close?
But in the end it was saved.
How close?
Probably within a couple of days.
Wow.
Some sources say within a couple of hours.
So Noah, today you can go to the church in Ghent and see this painting, right? I mean, it is now, we hope, safe and sound.
It is. It's been moved to a different chapel, and it's currently being restored, and it's absolutely spectacular to see in person.
How many times have you seen it?
I've been very fortunate to see it quite a few times, most recently just in September when I went there, and it stirs me each time, and each time I see it, I notice something new. For instance, I think that it may be the first work of the pre-modern period to show someone laughing, which I'd never noticed before, so it constantly surprises me.
That's Noah Charney. He's the author of Stealing the Mystic Lamb, a book about the Ghent altarpiece. You can see images of the painting at our website, npr.org. Noah Charney, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to report next on the future of the bookstore. The basic brick-and-mortar bookstore has been in trouble for years.
Let's do a quick review of the last couple of decades. First, independent bookstores were hammered by chains like Barnes & Noble.
Then stores like Costco moved in with their own book sections.
Next, Amazon and other retailers sold books online.
Some people wonder how long it will be before the e-book supplants the traditional kind. As we begin a series on books today, NPR's Lynn Neary reports that even the big chains are in trouble.
There was a time, not so long ago, when bookstore chains had a pretty bad rep. They were seen as predators, eager to pounce on and destroy the neighborhood bookstore. But independent bookstore owners Rebecca Fitting and Jessica Stockton-Bagnulo say that image is out of date.
That story kind of got stuck in people's heads. That was the only story that people, especially like in media, could think about, could wrap their heads around, was like, oh, isn't it sad that all the independent bookstores are dying and they're being destroyed by the chains?
Because people love a sob story.
Defying all the naysayers about the future of bookstores, especially in a tough economy, Fitting and Bagnulo opened Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn a year ago.
All right.
They knew the neighborhood they moved into, Fort Greene, wanted a bookstore, and that local support has proven to be invaluable.
All right, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. Are you ready for story time?
The store has lots of regular events like Saturday morning story time and author readings, but on any day it attracts people like Fort Greene resident Roxanne Powell.
It's good to have it here and to see it flourishing. I'm even feeling like, you know, I have to stop going to Barnes & Noble's and support my local bookstore.
Fitting and Bagnulo know that a delicate combination of factors has to come together to make a neighborhood bookstore succeed. But they believe this could be a good time for stores like theirs. Fitting says the chains belong to another era.
I kind of feel like we're like sort of coming to the end of the age of dinosaurs and there's all these little warm-blooded mammals running around instead.
If the dinosaurs are the two big chain stores, Borders and Barnes & Noble, the news lately hasn't been good. Last week, Borders reported a third-quarter loss of more than $74 million and confirmed that it is closing 16 stores. Despite its precarious state, one of Borders' biggest stockholders has offered to finance the purchase of Barnes & Noble, which put itself up for sale last summer. That offer helped to boost Barnes & Noble's stock, but many observers think a merger of the two chains is unlikely. Barnes & Noble says it's considering a number of options, including not selling itself at all. Bagnulo sees the chain's woes and the recent news that Google is entering the ebook market as something of an opportunity.
The potential is for there to be two trends, toward the sort of digital content, which is just sort of ubiquitous and everywhere, and then towards the sort of local boutique curated side. And the chain stores, unfortunately, don't have the advantage in either of those areas. I mean, they can't carry every book in the entire world in their store, but they also don't necessarily have the same, you know, emotional connection to their neighborhood that a local store does.
It's really hard for me to be sympathetic to the chains.
Elaine Petrocelli is the co-owner of Book Passage in San Francisco. She's been in the business since the 1970s and has not forgotten when a chain store moved into her neighborhood and almost put her out of business. The most recent threat to bookstores like Petrocelli's is the emergence of the e-book and Amazon's dominance of the market with its e-reader, the Kindle. So Petrocelli was heartened by the news that Google will make it possible for independent bookstores to sell e-books from their websites.
I think it gives us a chance. I don't think that it's a panacea, but I do think it gives us a chance.
Are you worried about e-books and what they mean for stores like yours in the not-too-distant future?
I think it's a challenge, and I think that's why it's so great that we can now sell them. I think that it's possible that the Kindle could turn into the Betamax. That's my nasty wish, because they won't share with other people. You need to buy your book through Amazon in order to use your Kindle. All of the other readers, you can work with the Google editions. And so I think that's going to be the coming thing.
Petrocelli might be surprised to hear that the chairman of Barnes & Noble, the very chain that once threatened her business, thinks they have something in common.
I think the biggest threat to Barnes & Noble is the same threat that exists to independent booksellers and to anyone engaged in the sale of printed books. And it's all about the Internet itself.
Book sales have declined for everyone, says Len Riggio, because whole categories like reference books and travel books are no longer needed now that such information is available for free on the Internet. That's why Riggio is banking his store's future not on books alone, but on the sale of electronic devices. Prominent among them, Barnes & Noble's own e-reader, the Nook, and its latest iteration, the Nook Color. But as important as the Nook is to Barnes & Noble, Riggio says the strategy for the future is to be device agnostic, because the potential market is huge.
We really don't care if someone has an iPhone, because you can read Barnes & Noble e-books on your iPhone. You can read Barnes & Noble books on your iPad or your BlackBerry. So we don't consider the other devices to be competitive. And we may very well sell some of those devices in our stores.
So the sale of the devices will support the sale of traditional books?
Yes, absolutely.
This past year, Riggio fought off a hostile attempt to take over the Barnes & Noble board and, along with it, his chairmanship. He won't comment on the potential sale of Barnes & Noble, though a decision is expected early next year. Still, he says this is an exciting time to be in the business, and he's anything but downbeat about his company's future.
It's pretty heady times, and we don't know where it's going to turn out. But if you want to count up the people who are going to have a say in how it does turn out, put us in as one of them.
And what about the independents? Will they have a say as well? Or will they just become precious reminders of a time when most people read books made of paper? Not a chance, says Elaine Petrocelli.
I don't think we're going to become precious. I think we're going to be a vital part of the future. But we're going to have to keep growing and changing.
All bookstore owners know this truism. The digital future is now. It's up to them to work it in a way that keeps their doors open and their shelves filled with actual books. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
An American writer moved to India and found a country that's dramatically changing. What may be changing most is India's frame of mind.
India has become, in a way that it has not been, a land of opportunity for millions and millions and millions of people.
A land of opportunity, he said. The journalist Anand Giridhar says that's new. Giridhar grew up outside Cleveland, Ohio, and then he moved to India, the land of his ancestors. His book, India Calling, describes India's growing economy and the new possibilities it has created, something we might see as American-style chances to get ahead. Yet he also explores a country riddled with ancient divisions of class and caste.
In India, you're eternally a master and eternally a servant. And servants, in many ways, have been seen and taught to see themselves as being not someone who is situationally inferior, but someone who is eternally, intrinsically inferior.
What happened when you encountered a servant who didn't quite realize who you were?
It was a really interesting moment in which I saw the truth about India in a way that I hadn't seen before. We had gone over to some friend's home for breakfast, and their servant was much loved by the family, had cooked us this fantastic breakfast, and he made this very famous coffee, and it was a typical elite Indian breakfast with all of the fussiness and all of the servitude. And a short time later, we returned home, and I realized that I had forgotten to drop off a mattress at these friends' home. So I had changed by then into shorts and a T-shirt from my fancier breakfast gear and went back to the house in a shorts and T-shirt carrying this mattress to give it back. And I rang the doorbell. The family had left, so the servant was still there. And he saw me and didn't recognize that it was the same guy who just had breakfast. And I was now wearing a shorts and T-shirt, and I was carrying this mattress, which made me seem like a kind of delivery man. And he suddenly was a totally different guy. He was cold and gruff, and he started barking at me, put it down there, quickly, quickly. And I didn't understand what was happening for a minute. It didn't occur to me that he didn't recognize me since I'd been there just half an hour before. And I realized he thought that I was a delivery man. And once he thought I was a delivery man, I had gone from being someone he had to serve to someone who had to serve him. And I looked at him and I said, I was just here. And I suddenly saw the man have this total human metamorphosis. And he shrunk right in front of me from a master to a servant. And his whole body, his physiology changed. And he started apologizing with his presence and with his words. And you realize that almost every Indian is engaged in both of these transactions at different moments of their days, superior to some, inferior to others. And as an Indian poet once said, never thinking to resist the one kick from above, nor to refrain from giving the kick below.
Well, let's talk about that. Did you meet anybody who managed to transcend these boundaries or move from one station in life to another?
One of the people I spend a lot of time with in the book is a guy named Ravindra, who is in his late 20s and was born close to the lowest of the Indian low, born in the kind of world that you can't imagine anyone getting out of. Something happened to him that has happened simultaneously to millions, maybe even tens of millions of Indians who were also born as quote-unquote servants. He got this idea, partly through television, partly through school, that he didn't have to be a servant anymore. And he basically self-educated himself with all these courses and certificates that are now all the rage in small-town India. If you drive through small-town India, every little ramshackle building is offering an English class or a computer class or a sewing class or classes of any kind. And he took like dozens of these courses. He certified himself in everything imaginable and slowly pulled himself up to being a computer teacher. Then he got a job at a travel agency. And at the travel agency, the real advantage of it was not the money, but the fact that he got to sit with middle-class people, many rungs above him in the hierarchy, and just watch them while he was selling them these travel packages. And he watched how they dressed, how they gestured, how they talked, what kind of cars they drive. He memorized everything about them and mimicked it and slowly set out to become them.
How did it work out?
He runs an English language academy, and he runs a roller skating academy. Roller skating is this huge craze in small town India. And he's a lecturer at like 7 colleges teaching people English. And he's made himself the guy in this small town of 50,000 in the middle of India. He's made himself the guy who you need to go see in that town if you want to get out of that town.
Well, you know, I want to ask you, as an American who grew up in suburban Cleveland and then went to live in India, you've lived in these two countries that seem to be at different places right now. You have an India that, as you point out, has this incredible image right now and is seen as the future, but you point out that that's actually very problematic. You've come from an America where there seems to be a great fear of decline, although, you know, we shouldn't miss the fact that it's still the greatest economy the world has ever seen. I wonder how the illusions are changing and how much the realities are really changing in these two countries right now.
There are two ways you can think about this. It is certainly true, the defining narrative that Americans have told themselves about themselves for a long time is anything can happen here, anything is possible, we change the world, we change our lives. And I think it is true that that narrative in America today is in decline. I think it'll come back, but we're not in a good moment for that narrative, and you're seeing a lot of resentment and fear and anxiety around that. It is correspondingly true in India that the idea that you shape your fate, that you make your destiny, was not a dominant idea in India and is becoming more of a dominant one. And so at a casual level, walking around America, watching TV in America, walking around India, watching TV in India, you feel that India is possessed by a narrative of hope right now and America's not. But your point is very well taken. I think in both countries, we tend to underplay the extent to which it's the fundamentals, not the narrative, that matters. In America, you take something like American universities, for example. You take the Silicon Valley ecosystem. You take the way the American legal system functions. These are kind of century-level advantages. It will take other people a very, very long time to replicate any of these things, and certainly all of them in conjunction. And I think in India, the opposite is true, which is there's so much optimism and foreign investment is flowing, etc., that people sometimes get deluded into thinking this whole thing is going to be wrapped up in about 5 years. But in many ways, India still has a lot to work out. And one of the risks of a boom is that it becomes easy to forget that.
Anand Giridhar is the author of India Calling. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jay-Z has been incredibly successful as a rapper and an entrepreneur, which is pretty amazing since he could easily have been in prison or dead. He was born in 1969 and grew up in a housing project, watched crack destroy his neighborhood, but he sold it on the street before he found his new life in the recording studio and on stage. In his new book, Decoded, Jay-Z offers his story as an example of the story of his generation, explaining the tough choices they faced at a violent and chaotic time. Decoded also tells the stories behind 36 of Jay-Z's songs. He holds the record for the most number one albums by a solo artist on the Billboard 200. His recording with Alicia Keys, Empire State of Mind, from his 2009 album Blueprint 3, has become something of a New York anthem. Jay-Z co-founded the label Rockefeller Records, as well as the clothing company Rockaware. He's the president of Def Jam Records. He's a part owner of the New Jersey's NBA team, the Nets, and co-owns the sports bar 4040 Club.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Let it bump, though.
It's the hard knock life for us. Set it, treat it, we get sick.
driving some of the hottest cars New York has ever seen. For dropping some of the hottest verses rappers ever heard. From the dope spot with the smoke block, clinging the murder scene. You know me well from nightmares of a lonely cell. My only hell, but since when y'all know me to fail? Nah, we all my niggas with the rubber grips or shots. And if you with me, mama, rubber your and whatnot. I'm from the school of the hard knocks. We must not let outsiders violate our blocks. And my plot is stick up the world and split it 50-50. Uh-huh. Let's take the dough and stay real jiggy. Uh-huh. Let's sip the Chris and get pissy-pissy. Flow infinitely like the memory of my nigga Biggie. Baby, you know it's hell when I come through. The Life and Times of Sean Carter, Volume 2.
That's Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by my guest Jay-Z, who has a new book called Decoded. So you tell a great story in the book about how you got the rights to use that song, to use the song from Annie, Hard Knock Life. Would you tell the story?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we got the rights already, so it was a bit late. So, because I exaggerated a touch. You know, and it's typical when you have to clear a song, you have to send it, a sampled song, you send it to the original writers and they grant you permission and you pay a fee for that permission. You know, but some writers, their art is, for them, very important. So it has to be the right sort of attitude and the right take, and the emotion on the record has to fit, you know, what was originally intended. So we're having difficulties clearing the sample, and I wrote a letter about how much it meant to me, you know, what it meant to me growing up, and how I went to, like, a Broadway play, which was an exaggeration. I saw it on TV, and, you know, we got the rights.
Let me stop you, because in the book you say that you told a big lie. In the book you say that you made up that you entered an essay contest, and in the essay you wrote about the importance of seeing Annie on Broadway, which you'd never seen on Broadway, in fact. And, you know, all that it meant to you when you saw it on Broadway. I think you said you, like, won the essay contest. And so you.
I didn't want you to put the whole thing out there. I was trying to, you know, I could have.
So in other words, you lied a little bit in order to get the rights.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a bad lie for a good reason.
Well, it worked out well for everybody.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for the song?
No, but someone just reached out, like, the other day and said that he wants to speak with me, so I'm going to reach out to him. I mean, just the other day as well, so which is really cool. I was in a house trying to I went looking at a house on the Upper East Side, and I saw this plaque on the wall. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's my plaque. And I guess it was his house. This is a couple years back. I have to share that with him.
Oh, you mean your Grammy? Is that what you're talking about?
No, the plaque for the record, you know.
The gold record plaque. The gold record plaque. Yeah. Okay.
It was like a lot of times platinum, though. But, yeah, that.
That's funny. That's right. Well, yeah. I interviewed him a few years ago. You want to hear what he had to say about Annie?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay.
Please.
About Hard Knock Life? Okay. So this is Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Annie, talking about Jay-Z's version of Hard Knock Life. And here's what he had to say about it.
He said something in the liner notes that it was gritty. He said it was gritty, and he felt that that was the way black people felt in the ghetto. And the fact is, when we were working on Annie, it was the first song that I had written the music for. And I wanted that song to be gritty. I didn't want it to be a fake. I wanted it to show these desperate times and these maltreated girls, et cetera, et cetera. So when he picked up on that, I was very proud of myself for that reason alone.
Okay, so he liked
it. Absolutely.
So let's get another song in here. And let's do 99 sure. Problems. We'll do the clean version.
Ah.
It's radio, my friend. So this is actually based on a story, loosely based on a story that happened to you. Would you explain?
Well, it's based on a generational story as well. There's a higher thing. Like, there was a time where there was a lot of activity going on Turnpike from New York headed south, because there were a lot of drugs going back and forth. And so the state troopers at that time just blanketed every single car, anybody that was of color. And it was this term, driving while black. And people were getting pulled over for absolutely no reason, you know, other than their color. So I just had to set the scene up. So now we're driving and we're actually doing something bad. You know, we're transporting drugs from New York to, you know, down south. And we get pulled over by a state trooper, but we get pulled over for absolutely nothing. We're wrong. The cop is wrong. This conversation ensues. And it's racial undertones. And he says, do you have a gun on you like a lot of you are? You know, just that statement right there. And the conversation between two people are both in the wrong, but are both used to get in their way. So there's this clever banter that goes back and forth between the two.
Okay, and we're going to hear the part of the song that deals with the story that you just told. And yeah. Again, it's the clean version, so a lot of the words are going to sound kind of...
It's the second verse.
Yeah. And I will say that one of the words that isn't clearly said here because it's distorted because it's the clean version is the word bitch, which in the context of this part of the song means dog, because you're talking about canine dogs here.
Yeah.
Because the canine,
that was the writer in me being provocative, because that's what rap should be as well, you know, at times. That was really directed to all the people who hear buzzwords in rap music. They hear bitch or hoe or something and immediately dismiss everything else that, you know, takes place. And everything has to be put in context. And when you put it in context, you realize that I wasn't calling any female, besides a female dog, a bitch on this song.
You know, is that in spite of the opening part that says, if you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I've got 99 problems, but the bitch ain't one.
Yeah, that was to lead the listener down the wrong path if you were looking for that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's 99 Problems by my guest Jay-Z.
Hit me. Yeah, it's 94 and my trunk is raw. And my rear view mirror is the law. Got two choices, y'all. Pull over the car or bounce on the devil, put the pedal to the floor.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.
Am I under arrest or should I guess some more? Well, you was doing 55 in the 54. Lost the registration and step out of the car. You carrying a weapon on you, I know a lot of you are. I ain't stepping out of the door, my paper's legit. Well, do you mind if I look around the car a little bit? Well, my glove compartment is locked, so it's the trunk in the back. And I know my rights, so you gon' need a warrant for that. Aren't you sharp to tack? You some type of law or something, somebody important or something. I ain't passed the bar, but I know a little bit enough that you wanna legally search my We'll see how smart you are when the K-9 comes. I got 99 problems, but a ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a ain't one.